Do birds suddenly appear every time you are near? Just like me, they long to be close to you. Why do stars fall down from the sky every time you walk by? Just like me, they long to be close to you.
Linoleum Knife, a podcast about films. Where nothing ever breaks.
Anyway.
Loud noises are never heard.
Anymore.
Crashing things down to the floor immediately after the music stops is not our way of life.
No.
We embrace. This is a home of calm and peace.
Tranquility. And a zen-like acceptance.
Of all the plates we break.
Perhaps
you missed last week's episode, which began with a plate that the wind knocked the shade onto the plate, onto the floor, with an almost...
perfect timing.
A precision sort of level of timing.
We couldn't have scripted it better.
Yeah. That's not happening this week. We've earthquake...
Glued
everything in the house. We have not.
No.
I did buy once upon a time, you know, after moving to Southern California and hearing everyone be like, ooh, earthquakes, you've got to batten down the hatches, which is untrue, by the way. I bought some of that earthquake wax that you're supposed to affix.
Breakables.
Things to, yeah. But it leaves weird
residue.
Yeah.
Well, things do fall over
on everything
in an earthquake. I mean, I we live on a hill, so like we don't get it too badly, but I've talked to other people.
Well, we live at the very base of a hill.
Still, we're, you know what I'm saying. It's not about height. It's about the
rock underneath you.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know.
I know people who had like, you know, all their plates fall out of the cabinet and shatter on the kitchen floor.
When?
When Northridge.
Northridge. Okay, that was 20 years ago.
Well, you don't think you're going to... You think we're done with big earthquakes? You're never going to be around for one?
Well, I moved here.
You are Dave White, by the way, film critic for movies.com.
Yes.
And I am Alonzo Duraldi, film critic for therap.com and What the Flick.
Yes.
On YouTube.
And I moved here, and I believe that by moving here... I have...
You made the earthquake stop?
...altered the geological situation.
Are you... You've buttressed the fault?
Yes. I'm a buttress.
With your buoyancy, sure. Rest assured.
I'm not just a buttress. I'm also an ass-goal.
You are an ass-goal. That's true.
I would like to begin this show... ...by reading a little note that someone sent to me.
On the Facebooks.
Sent right to me on Facebook. And that's honestly how you get to me, by the way. I'm not ungettable. Simply because I ignore all of the comments anyone ever writes on the boobies.com page doesn't mean you can't insult me to my face if you feel like it. You may directly communicate with me via Twitter or Facebook. And if you take the time... to do that, and you don't do it anonymously, which is what this person did not do. They signed their name right to it. You can tell me what's wrong with me. I, in turn, will tell the world what's wrong with you. And here I go. Here's the note I got. And I'm going to correct it as I read it so that you know what this person did.
Or you could just read out the misspelled words.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Okay.
You, letter U, are too... So it's from Prince.
I would die for you.
I want to send this guy back a note that says, I wish you heaven.
Is the water warm enough?
You, letter U, are too critical with too, T-O, high of personal expectations, comma, with your, you are, movie reviews, four periods, which he thinks is an ellipsis. You, letter U, gave Iron Man, small m, 2.5 stars, and you, letter U, always underrate movies, comma, I, small I, never cared before, period. But with Iron Man, small m, 3, dude, you, letter U, are, letter R, a effing idiot, period. No space movies are never what you, that's all one word, W-H-A-T-U, expect, take it how it is, comma, what the hell is wrong with you, letter U, period. That's an insult review, period. Ass-goal, A-S-S-G-O-L-E. That doesn't need to be bleeped because it's not a word. Under normal circumstances, if he had spelled it correctly and if I had read it correctly, we would need to bleep that.
Because this is a clean podcast. This is a
clean podcast. But ask goal.
Nope.
Not a thing. Apparently, it's made the Urban Dictionary, though.
Yeah, it's a...
It's an internet...
It's the new all your base or belong to us, apparently.
Yeah, it's an internet slide, basically, where you misspell it. And then you see that you've misspelled it because G and H are right next to each other on the keyboard. And then you think, hey, that's kind of groovy. I'm leaving it as it is.
Although, given all the other spelling errors in this guy's thing, I don't even know if that was intentional on his part.
I assure you it was not.
Who can say?
I can say. He's a dummy.
So, again...
And so that was great because, I never read the comments on movies.com unless someone... A friend comes and says, you really have to go read blah, blah, so-and-so, whatever it was. And so I every once in a while, I appreciate, hearing from the little
from
people.
From the fans. Which, again, the same ridiculous argument that people keep trying to make, that somehow being a popcorn movie means that you are critic-proof, which means that all popcorn movies are equivalent, which means that The Avengers is just the same as The Phantom, and John Carpenter's Halloween is the same as Rob Zombie's Halloween, and Four Weddings and a Funeral is the same as Something Borrowed. Like, if it's meant to be entertaining, you can't review it, and they're all the same, and they're all... entertaining, and anything you say about it means you're a bad person. Boo.
And that is an insult to the people who make those movies, not to a film critic.
Yes.
When you, as an audience member, think about a film...
As brainless, basically.
As brainless and inherent... Like, you've walked in thinking that you're going to see something stupid and that you somehow are better than it, and you are... performing an act of largesse by even going. What you're saying is that the filmmakers aren't as smart as you, that you know you're watching a bad thing, and
you just want to be entertained anyway.
All the things are bad and equally entertaining, and that's not.
Yeah, if you just want to be entertained...
What do you think Shane Black thinks about that?
Exactly. If you just want to go to a movie to be entertained, that's great. But you're assuming then that all movies designed to be entertaining are entertaining, which they are not. And that's the point of film critics, to tell you that they, that something you're going into to be a brainlessly entertaining experience is not even that.
It's one of the things that film critics...
Well, yeah, obviously. No, it's the only thing we do.
I don't even think of that as my job, frankly. My job... is to take the thing and write about it in a way that places it in the context of
the other thing,
life right now, and all the other things.
Sure. No, yes, we're saying the same thing.
James Rocky, our friend and fellow film critic, has said, I write about movies, which means I write about life.
Right. I write about everything. Yeah,
I write about everything.
Well, you know, and just this, but this is just an argument that drives me crazy. I mean, somebody that I know recently said something like, "Well, you know, you don't go into a McDonald's and then complain they don't serve you pâté." And it's like, no, but you go into a McDonald's and you complain when the fries are cold and the counter isn't clean and there's a hair in your shake.
Right.
It's like, I don't go into the Avengers going in with the same kind of, applying the same critical faculties necessarily that I'm going to apply to, you know, Ohazard Balthazar. But, you know, there is a scale on for a movie like the Avengers on which it succeeds or fails. That is worth discussing.
Yes. Okay, so you also had a similar experience this week with a person we won't name.
Mm-hmm.
Just to, because I think he's ashamed of himself now. I honestly think he is. If he's not ashamed of himself, I think he fears reprisal because he did delete and take down the thing that he wrote.
That.
But a big deal entertainment journalist tried to take you down this week.
Yes.
And called you in print a pseudo-critic.
Yes.
So great.
Which, as my friend James said, are you sure that he didn't mean Sudoku critic?
So, we've both had an awesome week.
Yes. Clearly, we've arrived on the critical establishment.
You got taken down by a junket blurb whore.
Yeah, here's what's hilarious. The person in question, before becoming like a fairly well-regarded chronicler of award season, assuming one feels that award season merits chronicling, was known principally before that as a blurb whore, basically. And mind you, the story in which he calls me a pseudo-critic was filed literally from the VIP section of the Cannes Film Festival after party for The Great Gatsby. Clearly, where all the serious critics were hanging out, talking to Leo and Baz.
I would have gone to that.
No, you wouldn't.
I would if I'd been there. I would have gone to that.
You would have gone to bed.
No. Here's why. Because
first, you'd have to get on a plane to go to the camp.
Our pal John Powers.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was there.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, he did write about chatting up Nicole Kidman.
Huh.
Because apparently, like, they know each other now or something.
He writes for Vogue.
Yeah, that makes he writes sense. For Vogue. He's the film critic for Vogue, our friend John Powers. And he either tweeted or Facebooked or something talking about Nicole Kidman, and people were like, oh, Nicole Kidman. But, like, apparently they're friendly.
I see.
Which I think is great.
Yes.
Because I love the idea of him, you know, just walking up to her and being like, oh, Nicole, and air kissing and whatever.
Nick.
Yeah,
no, he's not that kind of...
And which is not what happens. No. His wife, in fact, when this all was on the internet, his wife, Sandy, just wrote, meh, as a comment.
Love her.
Because she's great. So, yes, I would have gone to that just so I could hang with John and meet Nicole Kidman.
Okay, fair enough.
And been like, hey, Nicole Kidman, what's up?
I'll give you that. But yeah, so I love that.
I loved you peeing on Zac Efron.
Yeah, well, who didn't? I love that between, you know, like hors d'oeuvres and free champagne, he found the time to like diss me. And
not John, this other person.
No, the person we're not mentioning. And the basic crux of his argument was that I was a pseudo critic because I had clearly not read the book.
Which I have,
and anybody who's read my review knows that I have, because I mention it in a lot of different ways. And B, in general, since when is it ever the rule that you have to read the book before seeing the movie anyway?
It's not a rule. In fact, it's often detrimental. Yeah. And furthermore, Gatsby
is a book that you read if you're an educated American. But right. In general, no, I did not read The Life of Pi, and I don't think I should have had to, you know.
What I really think this comes down to is
I was mean.
The site that he writes for, this guy.
Hates the site that I write
hates
for.
Hates the site that you write for.
But what's funny, though, is the person who runs that site claims to never read the site that I write for.
Well, so they're right here. The person's writers do.
That cat's out of the bag.
So,
And it's funny because all this went down while we were in a movie. Like, it literally, the thing went up, it was talked about on Twitter, it went down again, and I'm just getting, like, my phone is buzzing in my pocket. We're right. Sitting in a documentary about the Source family at CineFamily, and I'm like, I'm oblivious to all of this, and I get out and I'm reading my Twitter feed, and I'm like, whoa, what went down? And then I'm Googling it, and I can't find it anywhere, right. And yeah, it's just a whole
new thing. So great. So yeah, let's start with that. We were at CineFamily. this Wednesday night. One of our favorite places to go.
Yes.
In town and also in our neighborhood, and which we were scolded the other night by Rena, who said that we should walk there.
I have walked there.
Yes. I have never walked there.
It's doable.
It is doable. It would be like a 25-minute walk for me.
Yeah.
I'm a slow walker.
You are a slow walker.
And it would be a good 20 to 30-minute walk for me, which is fine. I don't have anything against a 20 or 30-minute walk.
If this were New York City, we would totally walk it.
We would, because we would not have any place to park.
Right.
But we
or own a car.
But we always have a place to park when we go to Cinefamily. And it takes us...
5 minutes.
Ten minutes to drive
yeah.
from our house. Anyway, we were there seeing a documentary called The Source Family. They do not only show films with the word family in the title at Cinefamily, but they just happened to be showing a documentary about the Source Family. The Source Family were a hippie spiritual cult.
Yeah, they were kind of an L.A. phenomenon.
Los Angeles.
Even if you don't live here, you're probably familiar with... There was a restaurant at Sunset and Sweetser for a very long... For several decades called...
Two blocks from where we live.
Yeah, called The Source. It's where... Alvie and Annie break up at the end of Annie Hall, where he orders the alfalfa sprouts and the mashed yeast. That was an actual place. That was The Source, and that was where the whole thing started. And yeah, so basically it's this charismatic guy who had, you know, was a World War II veteran, you know.
Big strapping, 6'4" stud of a dude.
Yeah, like, you know, judo expert right. and all this stuff.
Like, killed a man. He judo chopped a dude in the neck and killed him.
Yeah.
And that was a scandal early in his life before he started the restaurant.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, he'd worked at some other restaurants and had gotten into, like, drugs and all this other stuff. And then, you know, so starts this restaurant, gets very into this kind of, you know, Eastern mysticism, hippie stuff.
Yeah.
Meets this young girl. Grows his hair long. Who he marries, you know, and suddenly, like, The
sword. And he looked like old timey pictures of God. Like long gray hair and the big beard and the everything.
Which at one point in his career he claimed to be.
Yes.
As we get on with this thing. But yeah, so this whole thing starts and they all move into these giant houses together and this whole communal living thing.
And they start make a their band. Own, they make their own amazing clothes.
Yeah, and they
like every woman, first of all, every woman in this place. is a stone fox, and they are all in like long maxi length halter dresses, and you know,
hippie
guys are all good looking and long hair.
I suspect that a lot of hippie communes wound up being like Harry Dean Stanton's sort of, you know, Mormon outpost on Big Love, you know, right. where the hot chicks get grabbed up by the powerful older dudes. And then, like, but I'm sure a lot of the younger competition guys get, like, removed or disappeared somehow, you know.
Right. But this is, this guy was such a dominant person that, like, he wound up not just having a wife, but he took 13 wives.
And they were all wife, like, number one was not thrilled about.
Wife number one, it devastated her. But the other 13 were pretty happy. The funny thing is someone, I haven't read the book, but this guy I know, Aaron's read the book.
Yeah.
One of my Facebook friends, a guy named Bryce, he's read the book. He was there were gay guys in the Source Family, but they kind of they eventually all left because they just weren't, you know, comfortable there.
Hmm.
And I responded and I said, you know what, you would think that Father Yod would have, or Yod or whatever he called himself, that he would have wanted a bunch of gay guys there, you know, so that he could have all the fly honeys to himself.
Well, you know, it's like we were talking last week about the whole, you know, the Paris 1968
right.
leftists, or a couple weeks ago, you know, and how they weren't necessarily down with the gay struggle, you know.
No, they weren't.
I'm sure the hippies, it was the same deal. It was like, oh yeah, love and blah, blah. Oh, ooh, that is, get out of here with that.
But so anyway, what's interesting about this documentary is that it's presented as there was nothing malevolent about this.
Yeah, group, I mean, it's
other not, than the fact that he was a super egomaniac. And,
yeah,
and thought I mean, he was God,
and people did like give him all of their you know worldly possessions, and so they had
well
you know,
whatever
he had several.
They, had, they didn't have much.
Well, I think some of them did because he had like Rolls Royces and all this.
But he had made his money before as a restaurant guy.
True.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're
right. He was already a millionaire.
But nobody, in looking back on it, nobody talks like acts as though like they'd been kidnapped or brainwashed.
No.
I mean, they were clearly into it, and they got a lot out of it, and a lot of like the couples that formed in that thing are still together.
Yeah.
You know, they all a lot of them live near each other they in all Hawaii.
Kept their, they all kept the names he gave them.
Yeah,
like, they, like, one of the guys is named Electricity, and he still goes by that name.
Yeah,
which is amazing.
Isis Aquarian is the woman who was like sort of the historian, like was constantly taking pictures and doing audio recordings, yep. Which is the bulk of the film. I mean, like, there would be right. no movie without all of her stuff, and she's the one who wrote the book about the Source family.
Yeah.
And so, she still goes by Isis Aquarius.
And the and the music, they made so many albums, and the yeah. music they made is mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Like, this crazy free-form...
Psychedelia.
Psychedelic freak-out stuff. The one thing that you can nail on this guy, and... the lady sitting next to us was into talking about it loudly and annoyingly, was that some of his brides were
under 18,
15, 16-year-olds.
Yeah.
And that is clearly a problem. But I also know that if you think about the history of of the world, and also of the United States, we still live in a world, first of all, where 12 and 13-year-old girls are routinely, essentially, traded into marriage for goats in
right.
many countries
sure.
in the world in 2013. But even in the you know
industrialized
United States, yeah. as late as and I know this from personal history, as late as 1957, a 22-year-old man could marry a 14-year-old girl quite easily because that's what my parents did.
Right.
And she was pregnant already. And so, and that sort of thing was in its own way scandalous, but not a thing that people ever got super upset about. They were sort of like, okay, well, you're pregnant and you got to get married. And yeah, you're underage and he's you know, of age. But
and in England, I mean, the age of consent is 16, right?
Yeah, but not even talking about age of consent.
Okay.
I'm not even talking about age of consent. I'm talking about the history of this country
mm-hmm.
and how we have, over time, we have extended the idea of childhood to reach
true.
At the minimum 18.
No, like in the 30s and 40s, it was still a whole child bride thing, like in the you know...
Especially in the South.
Yeah, in the South, like the Ozarks, that kind of thing. It was, you know...
And so, not to say that the past was good or that was good for young women, because it wasn't.
No.
But in 1972, we were still living in that mindset culturally.
Mm.
That's one of the reasons, I believe, that people are so easy to give Roman Polanski a pass. That's sometimes what I think. I think that's one of the reasons why people do that. Because at the time, especially in Los Angeles, in Southern California, you had, you know, the GTOs, you know, and all the Girls Together Outrageously, the very famous, you know, groupies were all underage girls. And they ran wild then, and they did as they pleased, whether they, obviously they didn't know all really what they were doing, but
right.
but we had a cultural mindset that sort of looked the other way with that sort of thing.
Right.
Where it was, well, okay, yes, they're not women yet, they're not adults yet, they're still technically children. But we hadn't reached a point, I think, in the culture where we were line in the sand.
Right.
This is underage, this is a child, and this is untouchable.
And this is also the first...
We were still living in that past where the gray area
right.
was very, very gray, and people weren't always freaking out about it. And we certainly hadn't yet come to that idea about teenage boys.
Right.
And that was always sort of like, look, if a woman who's 25 or 30 wants to get down with you and you're 14 and you're a boy, go for it. That was the way people used to think about things like that. It was like, there are songs written about that. Yeah. Songs that are popular today. Hot for Teacher and Stacy's Mom and all that stuff. That sort of like, well, you know, you're going to get some. You're now you're a man. And even now, even though we've got, you know, famous cases of female teachers having sex with their 14-year-old, you know, steroidal giants.
And going, and going to jail for it.
And going to jail for it. There's still this idea, and this persists, that that's not as bad as if that was a teenage girl.
Right.
And so, like, back then, even with teenage girls, it was sort of like, well, you know.
It was the first explosion of the youth, you know, right. culture and all that stuff.
And then here's the weirdest thing of all, is to even have this discussion, even to say this stuff out loud, is sort of to be seen as being an apologist for that period of time.
Yeah, no, and, which we're not doing.
Which I am not doing. It is completely, you know, leave the kids alone.
Yeah.
but back then, this was 40 years ago. 40 years ago, people didn't think about it the same way. They were upset about it, but they weren't saying, oh, well, you're a pedophile or whatever.
Right.
And in my mom's case, it didn't even seem like anyone was all that upset about it. They were like, okay, get married. You know, too late now. Too late to wring her hands about it now. You're 14 and pregnant, get married.
Right.
So, and that's how, that's how my mother could be 69 years old and have a 55-year-old son. The past.
Ta-da!
Things were different then.
Yes, they were.
Anyway, it's a great documentary that you should see.
I have no idea.
It is available on demand right now.
Oh, it is? Oh, okay. Yeah.
Drag City released it into theaters in a very brief sort of theatrical run. And I'm sure it's going to go
make
through.
Make its way around.
It's going to make its way around to places like CineFamily and museums and stuff like that.
Colleges.
And you know, cool art houses or whatever. But it's also available for you to see right now on demand.
Do you know via what?
I do not know how.
Okay. Well, I'll find some
hunt that down.
Put it on the Linoleum Knife Facebook page.
Okay, Star Trek.
Yes, not on demand, but showing pretty much everywhere. So yeah, J.J. Abrams is back with his part two of his retrofitted different timeline Star Trek. Are we going to get spoilery? Are we not going to get spoilery? How do you want to do this?
Let's not.
Okay, we're going to avoid being spoilery.
Yeah.
This time out, there are acts of terror being committed by a guy named John Harrison, who's a former Starfleet commander played by Benedict Cumberbatch, and he decides to...
What was the name someone called him on?
Oh, I forgot. It's like Herky Dirk Fuffle Flop or something.
Flamper Blip? Or, I don't know what the... It was someone on Twitter.
Yeah, I forgot. Yeah. Anyway, so he decides that, you know, after doing really terrible things, that he's going to go hide in this isolated area of the Klingon planet Kronos. And so the Admiral of Starfleet, played by Peter Weller, turns to a very angry Kirk and sends him on a mission to basically, you know, sit at the edge of Federation space and launch these photon torpedoes at Harrison, you know, because there's nobody else in the area, nobody else will get hurt, and it won't necessarily start a war with the Klingons, although the Admiral thinks that war with the Klingons is indeed inevitable. Spock tries to talk Kirk down off of his anger, but at the moment he's, you know, driven by vengeance. And then as Kirk begins to calm down, they kind of come to realize that there are other elements at play here and that perhaps they're being set up for something terrible on a much larger scale than themselves.
And then fighting. Lots of fighting.
Okay, that's as unspoilery as I can be with this thing. It's a lot of fun, and it looks great in 3D IMAX. You know, if you have an issue with Abrams' love of lens flares, you know, he's not listening to your complaints.
If you have an issue with anything that J.J. Abrams does, you're not the person to be watching this movie.
I suppose.
Because there are people out there who dislike what he does.
Right.
And I'm not one of them. All the way back to Felicity. Which I loved.
I did too. I never watched Lost and I never watched Alias.
Right. But the
I love Cloverfield.
Yeah. And I know that there are people out there who dislike him, who dislike these screenwriters.
Mm.
But let's say the rest of you. Provided you are willing to save your, hey, what about the thing and then the thing and that other thing? Provided you're willing to set that aside
right.
Until after the movie's over, you should have a reasonably good time.
Yes.
The action sequences are exhilarating. And
actually enhanced by the 3D.
And enhanced by the 3D. And on a gut level, that sort of boom, boom, boom kind of stuff is really great to look at. And I will go so far as to say the kind of stuff that makes me love summer movies like this.
Hmm.
Really visceral and visually memorable. They are in the service of a plot that doesn't always make functional sense.
No.
It whisks you along and tells you to just believe it while it's happening. And you can.
Yeah.
And like I say, until the end, when your friend, Bibbs, comes up to you and says, but this shouldn't have happened because that couldn't have happened.
And why did they do that?
Yeah. Okay, yes.
And you are forced to say,
yeah, you're right.
I also like the ensemble that Abrams has put together here and in this for these movies and the way that he has rejiggered these characters. I really like watching the interplay between Kirk and Spock and Spock and Uhura and, you know, Kirk and Chekhov and Bones and Scotty and all those guys, you know, like it's the, you know, which the original series obviously had in spades as well. And that was why it became so popular and endured for so long and people still love it so much. You know, these guys, they aren't just impersonating the old school version of it, but they've created their own kind of interplay that's a lot of fun to watch.
There's less of the personal interaction this time than there was last time.
Yeah.
Because there's so much action.
Right. And obviously this doesn't have the little jolts of surprise and pleasure that the first movie offered, because no sequel ever does. I mean, you know, you
can't discover something twice. Yeah. Right. But here's what I do really like about Abrams and his manner. There's a lightness that he employs with the characters, and a real commitment, I think, to, even if he's not going to always deliver, you know, the backing up for that with, you know, extensive, you know, interpersonal conversations this time around. It is clear that this is a family.
Sure.
They are a community and they all rise or fall together.
It's a workplace comedy.
In a way. Yeah. Or drama.
Yeah.
And I think that the there's more to it than sort of a grim battle mentality. This is about friendship and loyalty and sacrifice and connection and that's why I love Star Trek now, because they aren't lone wolf superheroes who are post-human.
Right. They rely on each other.
They have to rely on each other, because even if they're Vulcans or Klingons or Tribbles or whatever, or whatever that is that follows Scotty around.
Yeah.
They're anthropomorphic aliens, even if they're not human beings.
Sure.
They are all, like High School Musical, they're all in this together.
Well,
I think that's important, and I like that inherently more. Just, I'm speaking personally.
Sure. Well, and I think it's essential that Abrams employ that light touch, because this movie really does go into some grim, very like post 9/11 areas. I mean, they are really trafficking in the visual language of terrorism as we have come to know it over the last decade or so.
Yes.
There are moments that are uncomfortably familiar, you know.
Yes.
And the whole notion of like a, you know, a war possibly being started under false pretenses, you know, it touches a lot of recent buttons, which, you know, Star Trek has always done. It's always been about, you know, contemporary issues cloaked as a story of the future. But to keep it from being like, you know, a 9/11 movie, you know, the fact that all of the character stuff is there and the wit is there really goes a long way to make this as entertaining as it is.
Yeah, so it made me happy. I liked it more than Iron Man 3. We're going to compare apples to apples here.
I would say
giant,
yes.
Giant summer movie to giant summer movie. Mm-hmm. I liked it more than Iron Man 3. I liked it less than the first Star Trek.
Agreed.
It is, by the standard that I set up that made that guy so angry, it is not the pop art masterpiece that I want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
But it hits on enough cylinders that I approve. And it hits on more cylinders even than Iron Man 3 did. Because okay. I can no longer think of Iron Man 3 without thinking of all the items for sale on screen. All the things.
Point and click.
That I want to buy after watching Iron Man 3. Oh, I'll have an Audi. Sure.
I'll have a Sun Microsystems, right. Please.
And that's, you know, so I'm waiting still.
Right.
For the big summer movie that's going to knock me down.
Right.
And make me love it. That has not happened quite yet.
Well, it's early. We haven't even hit Memorial Day yet.
I love Francis Ha.
Yes. Though. Let's talk about Francis Ha, which is, I think, maybe my favorite movie of 2012 so far.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay. Tell us about it.
So Francis is 27 and living the kind of life that might make more sense in her early 20s than somebody at her advanced age. She's an apprentice in a dance company. She, you know, shares an apartment with her best friend in Brooklyn, but her best friend is going to move in with her boyfriend. And so Frances is sort of at loose ends, and as things go along, things start to unravel a bit more. She doesn't get to perform in the big Christmas show that the dance company puts on, which is going to provide her much-needed extra money. She gets a credit card and on a whim decides to go spend a weekend in Paris, where she winds up never getting to connect with her friend that lives there and just sort of wanders around jet-lagged and you know, then comes home. And, you know, it's the kind of movie where this character, in the hands of another filmmaker, could have been a subject of mockery, you know, for her entire generation. They could have really stuck a pin in her and watched her wriggle. Or it could have been a really indulgent portrait by someone of her own generation, you know, sort of showing this flaky, you know, noncommittal person as being greatly heroic. But instead, it's co-written by Greta Gerwig, who plays Frances, who you'll remember from Damsels in Distress and the Arthur remake.
Greenberg.
Oh,
don't remember her from the Arthur
remake. Well, okay, that wasn't her fault. But, you know, that's sadly, that is the movie that she has been in that has been seen by the most people. you know, and she's probably, like, the biggest actress to come out of what is known as the mumblecore movement.
Well, yeah.
It's co-written by her and by director Noah Baumbach, who did Squid and the Whale and
Kicking and Screaming
and Mr. Jealousy.
And Greenberg.
Margot at the Wedding.
Yes.
And you can tell the two of them really like this character and they want her to succeed. And their love of Frances is infectious, and you wind up loving Frances and wanting her to succeed. And you know, I just got really swept up in her story and really cared about how it was going to come out. And I didn't feel like the movie was judging her, and I didn't feel like the movie was giving her a pass.
She's a mess,
and the movie knows it, but the movie doesn't want to make her suffer for it necessarily. Right. And so when, you know, things turn out the way they turn out, it's just, it's, I got verklempt. I really was into it.
I'm going to make listener Diane very happy right now by saying something that's on her linoleum knife drinking game, which we will post
on the Facebook page.
One of the moments that you drink, like what you just did,
yes,
through a straw making a noise, mm-hmm, is when I say, in my review on movies.com, I said, dude, I'm pushing the brand.
Okay.
Yeah. I said that Frances is the logical extension of Lena Dunham's character, Hannah, on Girls, if 5 years down the road, if five more seasons into Girls, Hannah is still screwing everything up and not making her life work. Hannah is 5, 6 years, 7 years out of college, and things are still not working.
Yeah.
A succession of things not working.
Her act should be more together by this point.
To the point where, well, no, it doesn't necessarily, it shouldn't necessarily be more together by this point. I think one of the points of the film is that there's no such thing as an age, a numerical age at which you are supposed to have it together.
I suppose.
Because bad things can happen to you at any age. You can be 27, you can be 37, you can be 47, you can be 57, and something horrible can happen to you and throw you off keel. A death, unemployment, anything. Life just throws things at you. And if you aren't fully ready to catch it, it can knock you over.
Yeah, but so she's throwing her own stuff at herself a lot of times.
Often she is throwing her own stuff at herself, but in just as many instances, she is broken up with by her boyfriend, not because of anything she said, other than, I don't know if I want to live with you or not.
Right.
She is abandoned by her roommate. She did not see that coming. Mm. She's laid off from her job. Again, not her decision. So a lot of the things that happen to her are external. She's not great at getting back up on her feet after that because she's still quite young and doesn't have enough wherewithal and life experience to have perspective enough to do the getting back up onto her own feet. So what you've got here is a situation where if Hannah were 27 and things were still not working, she would be this character. And she's in such weirdness that she goes to dinner with some people who are doing much better than she is, and they all talk about how, you know, they love to go to Paris and they have a pied-à-terre and blah, blah, blah. And so the first thing she does out of shame over her situation, her inability to even pay her rent, much less go to Paris, is get a new credit card, go to Paris. Because for at least a weekend, she gets to say she's like those people.
Right. She even borrows their pied-à-terre.
Right. And
but at the same time, I think you're maybe being a little too kind here. Because you'll recall, before she gets laid off, you know, the head of the company is like, well, you know, maybe you should think about choreography. Right. Maybe, you know, like, she's trying to sort of segue her into other stuff.
As I also said in my review on movies.com, she isn't fully formed enough to stare reasonable suggestions in the face and accept them.
Yes.
She's not the best dancer.
Right.
And she hasn't proven that she can be a better dancer or even the kind of choreographer that she wants to be. She hasn't done it yet.
Yeah.
So everyone around her is being like, well, you're not so great. That's why we're laying you off. And maybe you should work in administration at this dance company instead. And she says no. And so I think that even though she sabotages herself sometimes, and that's, you know, a real thing she does, mm-hmm, she also knows enough about herself. She's not an easy character to get a handle on.
Right.
She also knows enough about herself to stick with the plan. And the plan is, I'm a dancer
right.
and a choreographer.
Right.
And I'm going to do it. I'm just not doing it yet.
Well, you know, the movie may think that there's no set age for you know, getting your life together.
Yes.
You know who does have a set age?
Who?
Dance companies.
Well, yes.
Modeling agencies. Yes. There are people that have a very distinct timetable yes, about what age true. You need to be.
That's true.
And she's in one of those professions, so, you know.
Yeah. So, another aspect of this is that she indulges in a lot of self-pity as well from time to time, even to the point where, you know, her economic situation, she feels is, you know, she deserves something better.
Right.
So she hangs out with people who are well above her
station,
socioeconomic status, even the people she, you know, rooms with sometimes.
One of whom is Adam Driver from Girls.
When they go off and are buying whatever they want to buy and eating at whatever restaurant they want to eat at, she says to one of them, "Well, you know, I'm actually poor." And one of the guys says, "No, you're not. Don't insult actual poor people by saying that you are actually poor, because you're not. Because she's not. She has all these resources.
She's living beyond her means.
She's living beyond her means. She's living in a world that is harsh.
Right.
If you're young and you move to Los Angeles or New York City, you better have some backup, because it's expensive as heck in both of these places.
Especially
New York.
Especially if there are particular neighborhoods you want to live in and ones you don't want to live in.
Right. And so, you know, she moves, you know, through the world with a certain amount of privilege. She's white. She's pretty. She's young. She's got a middle class background that she can fall back to if it comes to that. It doesn't come to that.
Yeah.
But compared to where she's consciously put herself, she's poor.
Yeah. There's also a great moment where she runs down the street with Modern Love playing on her iPod, and it's just an exhilarating.
Getting away from the character for a minute, I just want to, cinematically.
Yeah.
This movie is so beautiful.
It's in black and white.
It's in black and white, which is clearly, you know, like a nod to Woody Allen and
Godard,
Truffaut, and you know.
This movie reminded me a lot of Masculine Feminine in terms of being about, you know, young people with artistic aspirations trying to make their way in the world.
Yeah. And she, not she, the film, it has so many sequences that are just beautifully cinematic. She's run dancing down the street to Modern Love, and it makes goosebumps happen on you.
It's a giddy moment.
It's thrilling to look at. You know, all the effects and all the explosions and all the space battles in Star Trek didn't make me feel as excited as watching her run down a street.
No. And the final moments of Frances Ha moved me more than almost any of the giant Oscar bait, you know, serious dramas of last year.
I could
year.
Hear you being a little cryy.
I was a little cryy. Yeah. And it's not like it's not the kind of ending that is that necessarily.
It's not
sad or sappy or.
It's none of those things.
It's not a cry moment. I just cried because I was just so. Here's the thing for me. When I'm seeing a movie that I really love, part of me is always thinking, don't mess it up. Don't mess it up. You are doing so well so far. Don't take that weird turn or the easy or the lazy ending or whatever. Right. Don't mess this up. So when a movie manages to make it all the way to the other end of the tightrope, I just sometimes I get carried away with, you did it!
And moving back to the character, in my little notebook, halfway through the movie, I wrote, just in all caps, I want her to be okay.
And the movie does too, which
I was
so great
about. By the middle of it, I was so like, please don't ruin
your...
Please don't be ruined by the end of the film. I want this character to be happy. I want this character, I want things to work for this girl. And so, when the ending comes, it's very sweet and very moving.
Yeah.
I really love this movie. I think everybody should see it. Now, having said that, there are people out there who are going to hate it because they will hate this character. Because she is...
She's a test.
She's a test. Yeah, she's not an easy character to love unconditionally because she makes a lot of terrible, mistakes.
Let he among you who has not blown a new credit card on a weekend to Paris cast the first.
The bad reviews that I have read are sort of like, we just hate her.
Right.
That's kind of what it's about. You hate her.
Then, yeah, the whole thing is the whole enterprise is sunk.
Right.
Yeah. Not the USS Enterprise.
The USS Greta Gerwig.
Yes.
Is sunk for you. Yes.
This week also was...
That's it?
No. I reviewed something else.
What do you got?
Black Rock.
I didn't watch it.
Yeah. I love Katie Azleton on The League. I think she's very funny.
The League is really a funny show.
If you're not watching The League on FX, it's hilarious. It's on Netflix. You don't have to like or care about sports in any way, because I don't. And
every time there's a sports joke or a
reference to some player,
cameo by some NFL guy, you sit on the couch, you go, "Who's that? Is that a guy? Is that a somebody?"
No, I pretty much know by now from context that clearly I should know who this person is, but I got nothing. And if it's funny, actually, I think I like this show more than a lot of people who do like sports.
Yeah.
Because I've asked sometimes.
Because the show isn't, the premise is that these guys have a fantasy football league.
Right.
But it's barely about that.
Yeah, it's really more about just this group of friends who go out of their way to undercut each other at every turn. Anyway, Katie Azleton's on the show. Her husband, Mark Duplass, is on the show. Mark Duplass, of course, being one of the Duplass brothers who,
Jeff, who lives at home.
And Cyrus and the dodecapentathlon and, all that other stuff. So this is her directorial debut. He wrote the script. She stars in the film with Kate Bosworth and Lake Bell. They play three childhood friends, two of whom haven't spoken to each other in years over a misunderstanding, who go to this...
Not a misunderstanding.
Okay, basically, yes and no. Okay, Lake Bell's...
A banging.
Lake Bell's character
Banging.
Slept with Katie Azleton's fiancé and broke up their engagement, and so they haven't spoken since. But then later,
like friends do.
Right, but you later find out from Azleton that it wasn't entirely a one-sided, thing. Anyway, so the three of them go to this island off the coast of Maine where they used to go as children and to go camping. And lo and behold, whoops, they're not alone. There are these three guys. They're hunting, one of whom is the younger brother of this guy they went to high school with. And that night they're sitting around a campfire and Katie Azleton gets drunk and kind of flirty with the guy. And they go off into the woods and she starts changing her mind and he starts getting aggressive and tries to rape her. So to fend him off, she picks up a rock and hits him in the head and oops, kills him. And so then the other two guys who were his best friends in Iraq, he saved their lives. Although we don't quite find out how he saved their lives, but whatever he did got all three of them a dishonorable discharge. hunt down the three women. And so, it's cobbled together from a lot of familiar pieces, but it's not a particularly exciting or interesting genre movie. You don't get to know the characters very well. She doesn't lay out the geography of the island so that you always know where everybody is in relation to everybody else. There's not a lot of tension. It's trying to be more character-based, but the characters are kind of sketchy. And so I kept thinking, all right, well, she's not doing a very good action movie, but then clearly this is going to be some sort of metaphor about gender roles or about, how we treat returning veterans or something,
Because
there have been a lot of movies where, these sort of manhunt things are about something else. Like there was a 70s film with Cliff Robertson called Shoot about these hunters, and one of them somebody from one group of hunters actually shoots one of the other group of hunters, and rather than call the police, the two of them sort of arm themselves up and kind of go to war with each other, and it's a very sort of Vietnam metaphor thing.
Right.
But no, you never get that in this movie. It's really, it is what it is, and what it is not all that good.
No, I haven't read a lot of good
about
it.
I liked Azleton and Bell. I pretty much have only ever seen do comedy, so it was interesting to see, they do the dramatic stuff and the terror action stuff.
I think Lake Bell is really funny in a lot of movies that yeah, she's in.
She is. I mean, I remember her being like, she single-handedly made, remember Over Her Dead Body?
No.
That awful movie with Paul Rudd and like Eva Longoria. Where she's
I don't think I ever saw that.
Lake Bell plays a phony psychic, and Paul Rudd had been engaged to Eva Longoria, and then Eva Longoria...
Is Paul Rudd in every film? Is he actually now our Gene Hackman?
It's either there's a law that if you don't cast Paul Rudd, you have to cast Chris Messina. Anyway, yes, Lake Bell's very funny.
I thought Chris Messina was not Mark Ruffalo.
He is not Mark Ruffalo, but he's in everything. Remember there was that joke at the Spirit Awards? Did you watch the Spirit Awards this year?
No.
At the beginning, they did a fake trailer for some movie, and it was like co-starring Chris Messina and Ari Grainer. They just sort of wave at the camera, who are in everything. But yeah, it's not that good, really. The Black Rock, unfortunately.
Whatevs.
Yes.
Guess what we're going to do right
wait,
now.
Wait. Let's do DVDs real quick. And all then right. We can finally read that email.
Tell me yours.
Mine is a movie that I was thinking about yesterday anyway because we were watching Epic, which we'll be talking about next week. But it's making its... Don't give it away. I liked it more than you did anyway. But coming out on DVD this Tuesday for the... coming out on Blu-ray this Tuesday for the first time is My Neighbor Totoro. Which is we talk a lot on the show about Studio Ghibli and Hayao Miyazaki, and it's a great, great movie, and you don't have to have kids to watch it. But if you do, they'll love it. And yeah, and it's a gorgeous film, so I'm very excited that it's now available on Blu-ray. What's yours?
Well, this is a, hang on. I lost my...
Get it together, Dave White.
My notes, what did I do? Where's my note? I made a note to myself. Okay, here, I get my notes. Well, this is a coincidence.
Uh-huh.
Because my DVD pick also has the word neighbor in it.
Okay.
And we did not discuss this.
No, we did not.
Before the thing. This week, on Tuesday, Neighboring Sounds comes out on Blu-ray and DVD and streaming.
Okay.
Yeah. It is the first feature from a director whose name I'm going to butcher right now because he's Brazilian.
Okay.
Portuguese director Kleber Mendonca Filho. I can't.
I think
someone
it might
who
be,
knows Portuguese.
I think it might be Mendonca Filho, but I'm not
well,
sure.
Well, someone who knows Portuguese I'm can sure. help me out with that. Portuguese. If you would like to spell it phonetically for me in an email, I'll be happy to reread it.
Portuguese is not as close to Spanish as people think. Like, I think I have a better time faking my way through Italian.
Portuguese sounds like Spanish, but drunk is really...
I can't believe you said that.
It does sound like that to me. Drunk Spanish is what Portuguese sounds like to me.
I'm sure two mighty nations are thrilled to hear you say it.
Thank you. But the... this is, and I didn't review it last year because it had such a strange, fractured sort of release. Like, it came out in New York, and then it took months for it to get to Los Angeles to CineFamily for a week. And then in between, it went to these other places, museums and other cities. And so it was a very long, slow Cinema Guild put it out. And they...
So basically,
do as they please.
If it had been directed by the Dogtooth guy, you would have bothered to see it for the New York opening. But
No. It wasn't that. It was that I couldn't get my hands on a copy.
I see.
I there were no Los Angeles screenings before its New York opening, and my attempts to
get a screener
were sort of just ignored because I'm nobody.
Now.
That's a fact. I am nobody, and I may be beloved by the people who listen to this show, but I don't got the kind of juice that gets people to just say, oh, yes, by all means, let's send Dave White a copy of this art house film for a website that no one who likes art house films goes to unless they are dying to read a review.
I don't think
it.
Anybody who's doing that kind of release is in a position to turn down
coverage. Well, in any case, I didn't get a chance to see it before it opened, and then it didn't open in Los Angeles until like months. Now, at the end of the year, when it was awards time, they sent us a DVD.
Right.
But it wasn't because of me, it was because of you.
Yeah.
Because you were the Lafka guy.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway.
This is all fascinating, by the way.
Well, I just wanted to, you know, normally I do go out of my way to try to review things like this because it came with a lot of advance hype, you know, from all the major smarty pants critics were really into this film.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out they were right. It's one of the best movies of 2012. And as of 2013, it was still making its way through whatever theatrical release it was going to have.
Mm.
It's a Brazilian movie. It's set in a seaside town. On one street, there is sort of a connective plot. A guy is sort of investigating some petty crimes that have been happening in the neighborhood. And it meanders often quite quietly through the lives of the many people who live in this neighborhood. And it's about the socioeconomic tensions of Brazil. It's about, you know, community and how, like, tenuous that can be. It's, you know, again, like I say, the camera drifts from minimal plot line to minimal plot line to person to person. It's not about plot.
Okay.
Really. It's very sort of like Altman-ish in the way it just goes from talking person to talking person. And
like Slacker?
Okay. I mean, not, but sure. It's got astounding sound design in a way that is like just like upstream color. It's this sound experience to watch.
So test your surround sound at home.
Beautiful to look at. Again, just this very sort of like gorgeous art photography kind of cinematography. It has a sort of tension that, well, in the words of the Cinema Family write-up, they call it a daylight noir. And I you know, I can't say it any better than that. It's really, really great.
Okay, I need to check it out.
Definitely watch this movie. I'll watch it again with you.
I always get it confused. What's the other movie that Bibbs liked so much about the guy, the policeman who can't hear music or whatever? And there's like a gang of criminals who are using like percussion.
I forget the name.
It's like The Sound of Noise or the...
Something like that.
Yeah, I always get those two movies confused. They have similar titles.
They are not the same movie.
Okay. You've been sitting on this email for like a month now, so read it.
Long email. It's the only one we're reading today.
Buckle down, folks.
This is from Ben.
Okay.
Hey, dudes. Over the weekend, I finally managed to get almost caught up on the podcast from about New Year's till now. Still have a few more to go, but I should have it done tomorrow, which means he's had it done for months.
For ages, yes.
It was nice to see that the levels of excellence and awesome you guys bring to the internet and beyond, the internet and beyond,
ta-da,
remains consistently high.
As
I bang my mic with my elbow. Not that I doubted it would, but you know, always nice to have your faith confirmed. So my question pertains to a couple of movies from the 70s, manly action movies that both feature a prominent gay character. The Wild Geese and The Iger Sanction.
Okay, neither of which I've seen.
Oh, I've seen The Iger Sanction, but I have not seen Wild Geese.
I know of them, but I've never seen them.
Both of them were shown on a lot of Saturday afternoons on regular TV in the early to mid-80s, so of course they were edited. I didn't recall any of the gayness in either of them and was mildly surprised when I streamed them on Netflix, or it could have been that I just missed those parts when I was channel surfing during commercials. I've included the times of relevant scenes if you want to check them out at some point, give or take a few seconds. I'm going to leave the time code out of what I read here.
Okay.
In Iger, Clint Eastwood plays Jonathan Hemlock, an art professor / extreme mountain climber / retired assassin.
Another one of those. That old saw.
Who spends it? This is actually my dream life.
Really?
Really?
Yeah. I want to be an art professor, an extreme mountain
climber. You don't want to climb no mountains.
You're right. I just would like to be an assassin, though.
You want to sit in the chalet and have a cup of tea.
I want to be an art professor and an assassin.
Okay, fine.
While seated having a cup of tea.
Yes.
Where was I? He spends his murdering fees on high-end paintings. See?
As you would.
As I completely would. Personal side note, characters like this in movies like these might play a factor in my never finding lasting or meaningful employment. Anyway, the first bit of gay comes from Eastwood himself when he's doing recon on his first assassination target. He pretends to be a delivery guy and uses a flaming manner of speech when he talks to the target. In return, he gets called Cupcake, which isn't too bad considering what all comes later. On the flight back to the U.S., he's flirting with a stewardess who tells him she's really a skyjacker in drag. We could get sidetracked on all the racial stuff going on with the stewardess, but I'll just mention the classy rape joke he uses to put the icing on his seduction cake. We discover that Dr. Hemlock, his spy boss, makes a fairly decent pun about being bitter, has an axe to grind with a man named Miles Malot, a former friend and co-murderer who betrayed him and tried to kill Hemlock. And we see a picture of him dressed in camo fatigues, which implicates with implications that he's a dangerous guy. A bit later, Hemlock is sitting by a pool when a little dog starts humping his leg. The dog's owner is a wide-lapelled, leisure suit-wearing, porn-stash-having queen, none other than Miles Malot, who tells us that the dog's name is Faggot.
Oh.
From there.
There's a dog named Faggot in, like, that's come up in other movies, I'm embarrassed to
from
say.
There, it's just insults and innuendos and further evidence of Miles being a sleazebag predator. Oh, and another rape joke. Their final confrontation starts at about 1:09, in about an hour, 10 minutes, and ends up being more of a dismissal than the one-sided fight I was expecting. If this was a video game, Miles would be a lame mini-boss. I'm not surprised at the stereotypical way Miles is portrayed, but even with that, he's still the major threat for the middle part of the movie. According to Wikipedia, the book the movie's based on plays Miles as more dangerous. But as far as the movie character goes, if Miles was able to go on spy and assassination missions as Hemlock's partner, then he probably wasn't to be taken lightly. I'm definitely not up on my gay film history, but I can't think of too many other older pre-1980s action movies with an overtly gay villain. A quick Google search gave me a few examples, but not many. A lot of them were only over if you knew how to read the clues. Understandably so, given the times those films were made. Now I have not seen Wild Geese, so he starts talking about Wild Geese.
I can think of a few, like...
Hang on.
Action movies with gay villains.
On the other end of the rainbow, we have The Wild Geese, starring Richard Harris, Richard Burton, and Roger Moore, as the over-the-hill mercenaries who get their equally over-the-hill squad back together for a mission to free a political prisoner from an African dictator. They rehire their old medic, Arthur Whitty. When Whitty first speaks, you aren't quite sure if he's kind of queeny or just British, but the more he talks, it gets obvious.
That is always a tricky one.
He makes a joke about how working a regular job makes his dick limp. I'm paraphrasing. I kept worrying that his mannerism was going to be called out and he was going to be outed and rejected, but no, they say he's in. He asks how long before they leave for training because he wants to get a divorce. He says he can't wait to see the look on his husband's face. Everybody laughs. And scene. Since Whitty is one of the guys we know by name, he gets used for reaction shots throughout the rest of the film, usually comic ones. On the first day of training, Whitty falls while running, and the drill sergeant screams at him and calls him a faggot and says he's going to sew his other end shut if Whitty doesn't get up. I've watched that scene several times, but I cannot make out Whitty's witty reply other than it's God-related and another comic moment. Later, when the men are making their wills, someone asks Queenie, who he's leaving his mercenary money to. Whitty says it's going to his favorite proctologist and calls the guy who asked Chubby Cheeks. In the next scene, the men are allowed to go into town before they leave on the mission. They all load into a truck except for Witty. One of the younger guys says, "Come on, Auntie, we'll round you up a nice piece of tail." But Witty declines and says he'll be waiting for them to get back with band-aids and penicillin. Big laughs. At around 1:10, we finally get to see Witty be a medic, and he's very motherly about it. For the most part, he's treated fairly well, but when the mission goes south, Roger Moore makes a one-liner at Witty's expense, but not to his face. He gets to do more medic stuff to let Richard Burton know which guys are going to make it, aren't going to make it, and then he gets to be a badass and takes out several enemy soldiers. Spoiler, he dies, but it was the 70s, so I guess it's not a surprise that the gay guy gets killed. Despite being used for comic relief, there were literally only two times anything bad is said about Witty, the one you would expect a drill sergeant to say and about anybody, and the other was a random comment you'd make about a friend behind his back. Google didn't give me any other pre-80s films with similar characters, but I could have just been wording my search wrong. As I was writing that last sentence, I had Theater of Blood pop into my head. Vincent Price's character was not gay, but he did convincingly slash campily act gay to commit that one murder. So my question is this, if you guys know of any other older action-adventure movies where the villain was gay, but also actually a threat. Like not too many, like not too swishy or dependent on henchmen. And likewise, have there been many gay good guys who were respected by the other main characters in action films, as well as the script? I'm sure it's a short list. That's the end of the letter.
Well, I am not a giant expert of pre-80s action films. I have a couple. There are gay villains in Diamonds Are Forever, if I recall correctly. Like a tall guy and a short guy. I thought maybe. That was a gay couple.
I don't remember.
There is Ray Walston as the cross-dressing scientist in Caprice with Doris Day and Richard Harris. That bizarre Frank Cashlin movie.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
There is George Sanders has some weird scene in drag in The Kremlin Letter, but I'm not entirely sure if he's the villain or what the deal is with that. As far as gay helpers, not the there's also the killer in Freebie and the Bean is a cross-dresser who's implied to be gay as well. Those are the main ones I'm thinking of. What do you got?
I don't have any old ones, but the mechanic. The Jason Statham mechanic remake.
Well, yeah, but no, he's talking about vintage.
Okay. I don't have any vintage.
Yeah.
I have no vintage.
Listeners, if you've got any suggestions for either threatening gay villains or helpful gay sidekicks in pre-1980s action movies, drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
I do recommend that Jason Statham mechanic remake.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely.
The gay villain in that is he's brutal.
Well, he's not the villain of the piece, but
he's one of the bad guys, and he's brutal and murderous, and
to be taken lightly.
And yeah, you don't want to meet him in any street, alley, or daylight location. And so, long letter, short answer. There's not much.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure if I dug out my copy of Celluloid Closet, I could maybe come up with a couple of other ones. But yeah, for the most part, I mean, you have to remember that like overtly gay characters didn't start really popping up in American movies until the late 60s after the production code went away.
Right.
And then, you know, for the most part, they were portrayed as, you know, occasionally homicidal. June Allison, actually, as the lesbian killer in They Only Kill Their Masters.
Oh, well, yeah.
For the most part, you know, they were sort of treated as jokes or a minor inconvenience, you know, like the hitchhikers in Vanishing Point, but they don't count as the actual villains of the movie. I don't know if there's tons of either, but I'm sure there are examples and we're just not thinking of them. So if anybody's got any ideas, you know, let us know.
I also like, and again, not vintage and not a villain, I like William Fichtner in...
Oh! The best!
I like William Fichtner in that terrible Martin Lawrence comedy,
What's the worst that could happen? Okay, seriously, TiVo this movie... fast forward through every scene that William Fichtner is not in, but watch every second of William Fichtner.
Yeah.
He is this police detective who is like such a dandy, like with the most insane outfits and little yappy dogs. And you would think, oh, this is going to be like an offensive stereotype. But no. He is the smartest guy in the movie.
Yeah.
He's the one that everyone in the movie is terrified of.
Yeah.
He knows where all the bodies are buried,
right.
Connects all the dots, is totally large and in charge. But at the same time,
this huge queen.
At one point, my favorite part is when he's walking the dog and he's like, pull daddy like a chariot. Oh, I got to meet William Fichtner.
It's
of course,
so
the
great.
First thing I don't know is like, oh my God, I love you so much. And what's the worst that could happen? That is like such a great performance.
And what was his response?
He was like, oh, thank you. That was such fun to do. You know.
And no one saw that movie.
Nobody.
And no one appreciates his contract because it requires sitting through the movie.
The rest of the movie, which is all garbage. Just watch the Fichtner scenes. I'm telling you. Oh, so good. Okay. Once again, we thank you for joining us. And
what?
I don't know.
Did you just go blank?
No, I was going to mention something, but I'm not going to mention
it. All right, don't then.
Fine. as always, we remind you to check out our friends in the podcast universe, The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli. Our friend Gray Drake, of course, on if you have satellite radio, she is on the Rotten Tomatoes radio show, which airs twice a week at Sirius 108?
Talk about Team Jack.
I forgot. I'm getting to that.
All right.
Cooking with Malcolm Ingram, Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion cast, Throwing Shade, Team Jack. Last week I was wrong in saying that our episode had not been posted yet. It is up and running. It's called The One with the Whales in It.
Yeah.
And there is a really awesome episode guide that one of the Team Jack people.
An elaborate annotated
episode guide with GIFs and everything. Mm-hmm. We're going to post a link to that on the Linoleum Knife Facebook page. Check it out. It's a really fun episode. And
we don't deserve that level of attention, really, with the episode guide, honestly.
Yeah, and Jack was a great host. We had a really good time doing his show. So thank you, Jack. And we do want you to come on our program at some point. We'll make that happen. Also, check out the Schmoes Know, the B-Movies Podcast, Film Spotting SVU, Pod Crash, The Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show at iTunes and leave us a nice review if you would. There are like two or three new ones, by the way, which I'm sorry I don't have them in front of me, so I can't thank you by name. But everybody who's been leaving nice reviews on YouTube, on iTunes, we appreciate it. That helps people find the show.
Yes. And it buries that one guy that hates us.
Yes, exactly. So leave us a good review. That would be lovely. You can stream this program at StitcherRadio.com or on the Stitcher Radio app. You can also stream us at thelounge.com. Again, like our Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast.
That just made a lot of noise, didn't it?
Yes, you did. You can check into this program at getglue.com. And once again, drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with your thoughts, questions, top 10 lists, worst 10 lists, suggestions of gay threatening villains in pre-1980s action movies, whatever you got.
Praise for me personally.
Certainly. We love to hear from you. So anyway, thank you for listening, and we will catch you next week.
Goodbye.